Historian Alan Taylor on Maine's Bicentennial. In the years after the Revolutionary War, settlers from southern New England poured into what was then called the District of Maine, looking for a new life. Between the years of 1775 and 1790, the population of Maine tripled to almost 100,000 people. Many settled in what was then Frontier, and the going was far from easy. Not only did they face brutal cold, bears, and devastating grasshoppers, but many of the settlers were involved in a series of violent conflicts with land proprietors. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Historian Alan Taylor is an expert on this period, as well as the War of 1812, the politics of the American Revolution, and the drive for Maine statehood. He has twice won the Pulitzer Prize for History and is in town for two lectures connected with Maine's bicentennial. Historian Alan Taylor on Maine Calling, next. But first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. What was it like in Maine during the frontier days? Today, we'll learn about the people who came here and forged communities and towns, eventually leading to statehood for Maine. Joining me in the studio is Alan Taylor. He's the Thomas Jefferson Foundation Chair in American History at the University of Virginia and a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning author. He's written 9 books covering topics from Maine's frontier to the American Revolution to the role of slavery. He was born in Portland, graduated from Bonnie Eagle High School and Colby College, and he is back in Maine to give lectures leading into Maine's bicentennial celebration. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about Maine's colonial and post-revolutionary history? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Alan Taylor, welcome to Maine Calling. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Jennifer. It's nice to be here.
As a boy growing up in southern Maine, how did you get interested in early Maine history, or were you interested back then?
Oh, I was very much interested, and it's thanks to my mother, who would drive me in from Buxton in order to go to the Portland Public Library, and I would happily hold myself up and read all of the early Maine history that I could get my hands on.
How old were you?
I was probably about 10, 11, 12 when I started doing this.
Wow. I understand your senior thesis at Colby College was about Maine's role in the War of 1812.
It was, yes.
What did you discover that most people don't know?
Well, what I discovered that I ended up publishing my very first article about was that the future governor of Maine, the first governor of Maine, a man named William King, who was very pro-war as a politician at that time, and Maine was still part of Massachusetts in 1812. But William King was also a merchant engaged in the import business, and war is very bad for shipping. And it turns out that William King was secretly trading with the British during the war in order to maintain his business. And so this was a great opportunity for me to figure out different letters and how you put together a detective story in order to figure out something that nobody had known much about.
Was that the drug? Was that finding that out and being able to publish that the thing that set you on this career?
Well, it was certainly reading the William King papers, which were filled with fabulous insights about life in Maine and life in politics in the early republic. It was that general phenomena of being able to read the literally hundreds of letters from almost, at that time, it was almost 2 centuries ago. Now it's more than 2 centuries ago. It was that process of discovery that really got me hooked on wanting to become a historian.
Your first book, Liberty Men and the Great Proprietors and Great Proprietors, deals with a fascinating time in Maine history, the period after the Revolutionary War, but before Maine became a state. Mm-hmm. What a turbulent time. And I didn't know this. I'm fascinated that so many people moved to Maine during this period. Who were these settlers and what were they looking for?
Well, they start coming in quite large numbers during the 1780s, which is right after the war. And the war was extremely disruptive. It devastated the economy. And there were a lot of people who were having a hard time supporting themselves. And these were people who were living in eastern New Hampshire and also in eastern Massachusetts. And for them, to get to the frontier meant not going west, but it meant getting on a vessel and going down east. And so Maine was the closest frontier available for relatively poor people during a time of a depressed economy. And they came to Maine, and most of the lands that are in the center part of the state, especially between the Kennebec River and the Penobscot Bay and Penobscot River, that region was largely claimed by great proprietors, wealthy, well-connected men. And those great proprietors who owned the land in that region were mostly loyalists during the Revolution. And so these relatively poor people, many of them veterans of fighting for the Revolution, when they are looking for some opportunity, they persuade themselves that these lands of former loyalists would be available for free settlement. So they start going up the Sheepskit and the Damariscotta River and up the Kennebec and up Penobscot Bay and settling on these lands thinking they're going to be free.
These people, you note in the book, some of them couldn't live anywhere else. This was really a hardscrabble group.
Well, it's a hardscrabble land. It's hard to make a living farming in Maine, particularly in that particular region. And so you don't do this thinking you're going to get rich. You do it because you're trying to provide for your family. And so these were people who would have found it very hard to afford a trip, say, to go west to Ohio or western New York, which offered better lands. And so it's pretty cheap and it's pretty quick to get to Maine. But once you're there, then you've got a very hard lot of it to clear land and to try to farm it.
The proprietors, one of whom I'm most interested in is Henry Knox. I think mm-hmm. anybody who's driven up the Mid-Coast has seen Montpelier, the mm-hmm. mansion. Mm-hmm. Henry Knox wasn't exactly a saint, was he?
No. I mean, you know, looking at political leaders in that generation, you find that they're a mixed bag. And Henry Knox was a man of great accomplishments. He was George Washington's artillery commander in the Continental Army, and he contributed greatly to the success of the Revolution. But he was also a very ambitious man, and he wanted to get ahead after the Revolution, and he had the benefit of a fortunate marriage. He married a woman who was much wealthier than he was. He was from Boston and she was from Boston, but she was the daughter of a wealthy loyalist family. And it was one of these families that had the leading ownership right to one of these very large patents of land held by one of the leading proprietorships known as the Waldo Patent. And so Henry Knox sets out to make good his family's claim to this great tract of land. And it then put him on a collision course with these hundreds of settler families, some of whom had, the men in those families had served in the ranks in the Continental Army, are finding themselves now at odds with one of their former generals over who is going to own this land.
And this is just one of the battles, if you will, that you outline in your first book, Professor Taylor. I'm stunned by some of the material that you have in the back outlining the dozens and dozens, perhaps hundreds, I didn't count, of violent confrontations. Tell us what was going on throughout this middle part of the state of Maine.
Well, there is a lot of violence, but it's also restrained violence, if you can imagine such a thing. So only one person gets killed in all of this violence. And when that person gets killed, it's going to discredit those people who are resisting the great proprietors. But for many years, people resisted the proprietors by dressing up as Indians and mobbing people who came to do the bidding of the great proprietors. And these would be land surveyors coming to try to run lines so they could establish in a court of law that the contested land did fall within their patent. Or they were mobbing deputy sheriffs who were coming to serve eviction notices upon settlers who may have lost a court case brought by one of these great proprietors. So the local settlers were trying to seal off their communities against anybody who would be doing the bidding of the great proprietors. Now, they're also attacking those people in their midst who are trying to make separate deals with the great proprietors, who think the great proprietors are powerful men. They're probably going to win in the courts. They may win in the legislature. So let me cut a deal for myself and my family. People like that were treated as traitors to the community. And so the chief way of punishing them was to slip a hot coal into their barn, setting it on fire.
Mm. It's interesting to me that you talk about this not just in terms of, you write about this not just in terms of who owns the land and who will own the land in the future, but also how different people at that time viewed the very definition of the Revolutionary War mm-hmm. and the whole idea of revolution and independence. How did the idea in Maine in the late 1700s, what was the difference in the views of what the Revolutionary War meant between the so-called gentlemen and the so-called common folk?
Right. Well, we have this misleading idea about the Revolution that all Americans supported it, and they all expected the Revolution to turn out one way. The reality is that at least a fifth of Americans opposed the Revolution and actively helped the British because they wanted the colonies to remain part of the British Empire, which had provided them with a great deal of prosperity and a very effective military protection. And then among the patriots who support the Revolution, there were very different views of what they were fighting for. For somebody like Henry Knox, he believes that he's fighting for independence and then to preserve the property rights, as he understood them, that had existed before the Revolution. Whereas many of these common men and their families who are settling on these lands thinking they're free, they think the Revolution is going to be something more radical. They think it's going to confiscate the properties of these former loyalists and provide these lands for people who move onto them and do the hard work of clearing them.
In the end, is there a winner? Do the proprietors win? Do the common folk win?
Well, ultimately, it's a compromise. Now, it's a compromise that, you know, I'd probably say the great proprietors get 55% of what they're after and the settlers get 45%. And it varies by place. The settlers who lived on the lower Sheepskit and Damariscotta rivers, they got a pretty good deal and essentially got their lands for very small prices. But settlers elsewhere had to settle for a compromise that was more in favor of the great proprietors. It essentially, they set up commissions that would set a value on the land and then would set a value on the improvements made by the settlers. And then the settler was to pay for the value of the land without their own improvements. And many of the settlers were able to do this, but others found themselves unable to raise the money to meet the price of the proprietors. And so they had to go on the move again. And some of them moved up into Canada and others ended up moving to Ohio.
Mm. You know, we're talking right now about the, as you said, the region, the geographical region that we now call the Midcoast up through mm-hmm. Augusta, Skowhegan, Farmington. What about other parts of Maine? What was going on down East Maine during this period?
Well, down East Maine is not involved in these particular conflicts that I'm writing about, or not as much. There you've got people who live along the coast, and they primarily make their living by cutting wood that is loaded onto small sailing boats and then is sent down to Boston to provide fuel. So Maine is the primary source of energy for Boston at that time. And people living right along the coast, particularly in down East Maine, that's how they make their living. And you don't make much money doing that, but you can support a family. Now, some of these people then are going into the interior to cut wood, and they are not going to be obeying property lines. There are great proprietors up there, and they are really struggling to get settlers to go up to a place like Goldsboro and into the interior. And they have a battle then with the coastal people who are going into the woods and cutting down the trees in order to turn it into cordwood that will be sent to Boston.
So their problem isn't with the settlers that are there. They want to lure settlers. Their problem is that there aren't enough people to do the work.
Yeah, people don't want to live upstream in that area because it's an even harder place to grow crops.
And what about southern Maine? What about the Portland area, I believe then called Falmouth?
Yeah. Well, that's a region that had been settled in the colonial era. So people's property rights were better established, and there were not these very large proprietorships that prevailed in the central part of Maine.
All right. I want to read a quote that you use in Liberty Men and Great Proprietors. This is from William Frost of York, and he's describing the political scene, and he says, "There is nothing but tumult and noise and freethinkers, prognosticators, lawmakers, and devil knows what stirring about nowadays." An apt description of the settlers in Maine?
Well, it's an apt description of politics in Maine and Massachusetts during the 1780s. And so Mr. Frost is regretting that the turmoil of the American Revolution is not over. The turmoil is not just about fighting the British. It's also turmoil between Americans over what will the revolution mean, who will benefit from it, and who won't. And from Mr. Frost's perspective, there are too many common people who are agitating for too many radical changes, and he wants everything to just calm down.
Interesting we're having this conversation today. I think people still are debating what the revolution means, but not in those words.
Yeah, we still debate it. Many of the things that we dispute in our politics today go back to the American Revolution. And I think we don't always realize that because we have this mistaken notion of the American Revolution as a movement by consensus, as if all good Americans agreed on what kind of government they wanted and how property would be distributed. And in point of fact, there were very fierce disputes over that.
Tonight's lecture that you're giving in Portland as a benefit for the Tate House is about the politics leading to statehood. I think most people know that Maine became a state in 1820 as part of the Missouri Compromise. What else is important to know?
Well, it's important to know that there had been a very long movement to try to separate Maine, but it had not been successful, even though it had been going on for just about 30 years, in that many people, because they lived along the coast, their economic interests were tied to Boston. And so they thought that having a separate state might work against their economic interests. And so the future state was quite divided, with people living in the interior of Maine more in favor of it, in part because they hoped that having their own state legislature and their own governor might be more sympathetic to settlers than the Massachusetts legislature, which was very sympathetic to the great proprietors.
I understand that many of these people felt as though Massachusetts wasn't protecting them.
It wasn't. No, Massachusetts was looking after the interests of great landholders who lived in Massachusetts.
We're talking with historian Alan Taylor. This conversation is part of our coverage of Maine's bicentennial. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Evergreen Home Performance, dedicated to helping homeowners qualify for Efficiency Maine Energy Audit and Insulation Rebates. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
In the 1980s and 90s, activists fought to fast-track AIDS medicines by confronting the government. Now they're back at it. The new target? Cheaper access to an HIV prevention pill. I'm Ari Shapiro, taking on the high price of HIV medication this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up later at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. Join us this evening on Maine Public Television for Science Night. At 8, it's Nature with The Soul of the Elephant, as nature provides a window into their remarkable lives. At 9, it's Nova and Inside Einstein's Brain, as Nova reveals the simple but powerful ideas that reshaped our understanding of gravity, illuminating the theory of general relativity and Einstein's brilliance as never before. Wednesday night, Science Night, the smartest night on television, tonight on Maine Public Television.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the history and stories of Maine's early years. Joining me, Alan Taylor, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and professor of American history at the University of Virginia. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining me on the line now is Liam Rorden. He is professor of history at the University of Maine at Orono and the main organizer of the University of Maine State Bicentennial Conference, as well as its Maine History Festival and keynote event this Friday. Thanks for calling in, Liam.
Hi, Jennifer and Alan. Nice to be on the line.
Tell us about the events you have coming up starting tomorrow.
So the Maine Bicentennial Conference is a three-day event, Thursday through Saturday, that is open to the public, but it's a fairly traditional history conference with seven academic panels. So I think the aspect of the conference that might be of most interest to your listeners, both occur on Friday afternoon. And this is first the Maine History Festival, which will run from 2:30 to 4:30 p.m. in the large lobby space at the Collins Center for the Arts at the University of Maine campus in Orono. And this is kind of an innovative attempt to reach across boundaries with 50 different presenters, from middle school students to graduate students to local historical societies and genealogical societies, all doing informal one-on-one presentations about their passion revolving around Maine history, society, and culture. So that's free and open to the public. It includes a reception, and it's really a chance to just connect and share our interest in the history of Maine. And then immediately after the festival at 5 p.m. is the keynote event of the conference, where we are really fortunate that two of the most distinguished historians of early American history of the current generation both have written great work about Maine in the statehood era. Obviously, one of these is your guest today, Alan Taylor, and he'll be joined at the keynote event by Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, who wrote a well-known book about a Maine midwife, also from this same late 18th, early 19th century era of Maine statehood.
And so that's at 5 o'clock, right?
The public, 5 o'clock, next door to the Collins Center of the Arts in Orono.
Well, Liam, thanks for joining us. We've posted information about that on our Maine Calling Facebook page and webpage, and Laurel Thatcher Ulrich is our guest tomorrow on Maine Calling. So thank you so much for bringing her to Maine, and thanks for bringing Alan home to Maine for this event. Thank you so much for calling in, Liam Rorden from the University of Maine. I'm going to go to Andrea, who is calling from a fifth grade classroom in Brunswick. Hi, Andrea. Go ahead.
Hello, and my class would like to say hello. Hold on.
Hello, Professor Taylor!
Hello, Professor
Taylor.
That
was great.
I hope you heard it. We are studying the Revolutionary War right now and Maine's role during that time. And one of our Brunswick natives, Samuel Thompson, had a bit to play in that, and I understand that he took 50 of his Brunswick militia with him to Portland, and I would love for you to tell that story and then also answer the question, what was he thinking?
Well, thank you for that question. It's a wonderful question. Samuel Thompson is one of my favorites, and I wish we knew more about him. Thompson was a man who was a very strong populist. And he is one of those people who believe that the American Revolution should change society in ways that would allow more authority, power, respect to common people. And he was a great critic of the great proprietors. And so during the Revolution, he is a very aggressive person. In many ways, he's like Ethan Allen of Vermont, in that Thompson thought that some of the established local leaders, particularly in Falmouth, the future Portland, were too willing to compromise with the British. And so he led his militiamen from Brunswick down to Falmouth to basically take control of the situation.
Andrea, do you have any other questions from your students before we let you go?
Well, the follow-up on that is that he took them down there, and then he had a little interaction with Captain Mowat, and then there seemed to be some burning, some fire that went on in Portland and burned down the whole city.
Right. It's better described as a town at that point, but you're right. It's the leading town in Maine. And the local people of the town, their leaders, were trying to compromise with the British, who had this warship in their harbor, because they didn't want the town to get damaged. And Thompson comes in and takes a very hard line toward the British and says to the local people in Falmouth, you need to stop supplying this British ship. And Thompson then started harassing British sailors who'd come on shore. And this quite upset the British captain. This is all happening the very first months of the war. So everybody's trying to figure out what's going on. This is before independence has been declared by Congress. So people aren't certain whether or not there's going to be some sort of reconciliation. And Thompson wants to make sure there isn't a reconciliation. He's somebody who wants to have independence, and he wants a more radical settlement of politics. And so he is using this opportunity to try to score points. But the British commander has the superior force, so he uses it and opens fire and burns down most of Falmouth.
Andrea, thank you so much for calling, and hi to your classroom. I really appreciate you taking part in Maine Calling today. They're calling from Brunswick. In Liberty Men, you talk about the founding of Bowdoin College, speaking of great proprietors. Can you tell us where that land came from?
Well, Bowdoin College is founded, and I say this as a graduate of Colby, so being able to say something to score some points against Bowdoin is very tempting. Bowdoin is named for the Bowdoin family, and the Bowdoin family were a set of great proprietors. And one of them, James Bowdoin, would become one of the governors of Massachusetts after the Revolution. And he is a relatively conservative man who is defending the interests of the great proprietors. And James Bowdoin would play a leading role in suppressing a populist movement known as Shays Rebellion, which was centered especially in western Massachusetts. So the Bowdoin family was a conservative family, a wealthy family. They are great proprietors, but they're also benefactors who helped to found Bowdoin College, which is the first institution of higher education founded in Maine.
Kent Mulliken says, I would like to say hello to my distinguished friend, Alan Taylor, and ask what other Maine-born historians have made important contributions to our knowledge of their native state?
Well, it's very nice to hear from Kent. He was the assistant director of the National Humanities Center, where I had the good fortune to have a fellowship. As for other historians, you could go back. You could say somebody like Joshua Chamberlain, who was a president of Bowdoin and who also wrote a great deal about his Civil War experiences. You can think about Heather Richardson, who more recently has done work on 19th century United States history. And let me think who else. Certainly, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich is not from Maine, but she's written an absolutely spectacular book in A Midwife's Tale. So there are a few of us who've been working away on it.
We'll go to Lynn, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Lynn. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to ask Professor Taylor if he's done any work in his research on the Native American cultures in Maine that were here, of course, long before white people were, and how that Native American culture was impacted by the arrival of white people, especially by the lumber industry and the clearing of the land. And in connection with that, I'm curious to know if he's read the novel by Annie Proulx, Proulx, called Buckskins, which addresses exactly this situation.
I'm afraid that I haven't read the novel, but I very much would like to. I've done a very little bit of work about Native peoples and their dispossession as the backdrop to this story. So I've been telling primarily a story about settlers against great proprietors. From a Native perspective, they are getting the short end of the stick from both of those sets of people, in that the settlers are moving in and helping to displace Native peoples, and the great proprietors are using their political might to accelerate this process of dispossession and deforestation as well. I've done much more work about Native peoples in what is now New York and Ontario, and I think it's a fairly common process that's played out across the continent. Certainly in Maine, Native peoples had been a very formidable presence through the 1750s when they had benefited from an alliance with the French based up in Canada and had been supplied then with the munitions they needed to defend their homelands and to try to roll back settlements. And that's one of the prime reasons why there wasn't much settlement of Maine further north and east of, say, Brunswick or some of the coastal islands like Monhegan, and a little bit around Waldoboro and Thomaston. There wasn't much settlement of Maine in central Maine or eastern Maine until after the British triumphed in their war over the French that culminated in a peace treaty in 1763.
Lynn, thanks for your question. We have a Facebook message from Nick. I would love to hear more about the early settlement that was near the present-day village of Sheepscot along King's Highway.
I probably won't be able to say too much about it. What I can say is about that region in general is there's a man, an ambitious man during the 1730s named David Dunbar. And Dunbar knows that there are a set of overlapping claims by rival great proprietors to the Sheepscot Valley and Damariscotta Valley lands. So he says none of these claims are probably any good. And he is working with the British Crown to try to get possession of these lands. And he brings in several hundred settlers, most of whom are from Northern Ireland. And they are a people that we later came to call the Scots-Irish. And we think of the Scots-Irish settling in around, say, Londonderry, New Hampshire, or on the Pennsylvania frontier or the North Carolina frontier. Well, some of them came up to the Sheepscot and Damariscotta Valleys, and they are Dunbar settlers. But ultimately, the English Crown would tell Dunbar, sorry, we don't want to get involved in this legal controversy. And so the settlers are then just left there, and they will play a key role in resisting the great proprietors.
All right. Well, thank you for that question. A question from Paul. Does Alan Taylor know of documentation on screamers, giant wildcats like panthers in Maine?
I don't. I'd love to know more about them.
And a tweet, what about Commander Tucker?
Well, Commander Tucker is from Bristol, and he is one of these people who holds a land claim, I believe, descended from the Dunbar claim. And he is he rallies local support. And he is one of the reasons why it is settlers in that particular region who have the political clout in Massachusetts to get their interests better taken care of than the settlers elsewhere in Maine.
All right. We're going to go to Alan, who's calling from Kennebunk. Hi, Alan. Go ahead.
Hi. Let me turn off my radio here. There we go. Yes, I'm curious about what role slavery played in the settlement of Maine.
Very little, in that Maine's part of Massachusetts, and Massachusetts is one of the first states to emancipate enslaved people. And it is one of the very few states that emancipates them immediately. Most of the northern states adopted programs of very gradual emancipation that would stretch out over a generation. But in Massachusetts, it's a pair of legal decisions in 1780 that declared that slavery is incompatible with the Massachusetts state constitution. And so there are no enslaved people in Maine after 1780. There are small numbers of African Americans who are free and are among the settlers living on the coast, but their numbers are very small.
Thanks for your question. We're speaking with Alan Taylor, professor of history, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, and also a Maine native. He is an expert on Maine in colonial, revolutionary, and post-revolutionary times. What are your questions? 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can email us at talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the Lunder Foundation, in support of the Colby College Museum of Art, always free and open to all.
Is society ready for driverless cars? In fact, do we need them?
Worldwide, 1.3 million people die on our roads every year.
I also don't want my kid in a world where there are two-ton killing machines programmed to kill children and save the driver.
I'm John Donvan. On the next Intelligence Squared US, four experts debate this resolution. All hail the driverless car.
That's coming up at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with children's book author and illustrator Myra Kalman and her son, designer Alex Kalman, about their new book and museum exhibit, Sarah Berman's Closet, the story of her mother, his grandmother, who went from a shtetl to Tel Aviv to New York, and at age 60, left her husband, started a new life, and wore only white. Join us.
And that's coming up this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, historian and author Alan Taylor. We're talking about Maine's early history. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Alan Taylor, a lot of people consider Maine's bicentennial founding in March of 1820, but Norman Brunel sent a historical document into me dated June 19th, 1819, from the government of Massachusetts declaring, I should have underlined this, that Maine was a separate district, separate from the Massachusetts proper. And he believes we should be celebrating now.
Well, of course we should celebrate for the whole year. What's the point of having
why
a bicentennial if it's not a whole year long?
Why did it take a year or almost a year?
You know, this is a legal process. It's a legal constitutional process, and there are many different steps to it. So the document in June of 1819 doesn't declare Maine a state. It just says that Massachusetts is willing to cooperate with Maine's people in a process that could culminate in statehood, but there are certain steps that have to be followed. So one of the things that piece of legislation said was that half of the public lands in Maine would remain the property of Massachusetts. So Massachusetts wasn't going to give up Maine and allow it to keep all of these millions of acres of woodlands. Massachusetts wants 50% of it. And then Maine has to hold a referendum. And it's only if they can get at least 55% of the vote in favor of separation will Massachusetts then continue with this process. And they got more than 55%. They won by more than 2-1 in this referendum in July of 1819. Then the next step is they have to have a constitutional convention, and they have to write a new constitution for a new state. And then that constitution has to be submitted to Congress. And Congress has to admit Maine as a state. And so it's only when all of that happens, and it has to happen, according to this Massachusetts law, by the end of March 1820, or the whole deal is off.
Was it ever close? Did it ever look as though it might not happen?
Sure, because it gets entangled in politics and Congress. Everything was going very smoothly until December of 1819. You had an overwhelming vote for separation. You had a constitutional convention that reached a consensus pretty quickly about what this new constitution would look like. Then they submit it to Congress, and then they find out that there is an ongoing dispute in Congress over admitting Missouri into the Union, where northern representatives wanted to require Missouri to adopt a program of gradual emancipation of their enslaved people. And Missouri's leaders refused to do that. And Southern congressmen were outraged. They said, you must admit Missouri. And so they see a bit of leverage when congressmen in favor of Maine's admission try to introduce legislation to admit Maine as a state. And these southern congressmen and some of their northern supporters said, no, it's a package deal. Missouri must come in with slavery or Maine cannot join the Union. And so it's only when enough northern congressmen gave in and said, okay, that's the deal. And that became the deal in February of 1820.
An email from Tim. I'm currently researching a person born in Falmouth, parentheses Portland, Maine, who during the Revolution is said to have fled to Castine, then Passamaquoddy Bay. Reportedly, Colonel Allen sent a party to search for him, but he escaped to Halifax and ultimately settled in New Brunswick. Do you know any sources that might help me find out more about this loyalist?
Well, I think in general you want to look for the Loyalist Claims Commission records to see if he submitted something to that. A good place to start is a book by Mary Beth Norton about loyalists because she used these Claims Commission records very closely. And so by going through her footnotes, he could find sources on this Claims Commission. And in all likelihood, someone like that would have put in a claim and would have explained his services to the Crown and would have explained the property that he had lost to confiscation by the Patriots.
We'll go to Thomas calling from Madawaska. Hi, Thomas. Go ahead.
Hi. I'd like to ask Alan about the role that Benjamin Franklin played in determining the northern border of Maine when he wrote the Treaty of Paris between the United States and England, and then the role of the Webster-Ashburton treaty that was eventually determined the northern border. I believe Benjamin Franklin wrote that the border should be determined by where the rivers flow north would be British territory, and where the rivers flowed south should be American territory, but the Webster-Ashburton Treaty never arrived at that conclusion. They arrived at the St. John River as the border. Does he have any comment on that?
Well, what I would say is it's not Franklin alone. Franklin is a member, an important member of the Peace Commission that also includes John Adams and Henry Lawrence, and this and John Jay. And Franklin's actually quite ill during the negotiation, so he doesn't play a leading role. It's really more Jay and Adams. And Adams is the one who really cares about this issue because Adams is from Massachusetts, and Massachusetts at that time held on to Maine. Now, the negotiators were reliant upon a map, the John Mitchell map. And the map is an inaccurate one. So they are saying we want to have this boundary go along the watershed, in which the waters that flow northwards into the St. Lawrence, they will be part of British Canada, and the waters that flow southward will be part of Maine and therefore the United States. The problem is that Maine has an eastern boundary at Passamaquoddy. And the St. John's River, which empties out into the Bay of Fundy, flows then through a British province. It's then part of Nova Scotia, but it soon will become part of New Brunswick when New Brunswick is split off. So the dispute is fundamentally over the lands that are along the upper St. John River, where the British are saying the watershed is such that all of the lands that are drained south of the St. John's are part of Maine in the United States, whereas all the lands that are drained by the St. John River and by tributaries of the St. Lawrence are part of Canada. And that particular area, a certain segment of it, is of enormous strategic importance to the British because it is their wintertime road between their capital city of Quebec and the maritime provinces of New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. So the Webster-Ashburton Treaty if the United States really wants to play a hard line, they insist on going back to the Mitchell map. But Daniel Webster understood that it was not a good time for the United States to go to war, and that they could strike a compromise which gave most of the upper St. John drainage to the United States, but reserved that part of it, which was of greatest value to the British, to the British claim. So it's a political compromise of an issue that could have led to war, but in which neither the British nor the United States thought that they should go to war over it.
Thomas, thanks for your good question. We'll go to Pete, who's calling from Winthrop. Hi, Pete. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Oh, am I live? Oh, I just wanted to check on one thing. I'm an old man, and my memory is not too good, but I think Ethan Allen came from the New Hampshire Territory, not Vermont, which became Vermont later on. And the other thing, I was just talking about the border anyways. I'd like to know more about it and how Campobello got cut off from the United States. In other words, why is the border the way it is right now?
Okay, let me take on the Ethan Allen. Ethan Allen's originally from Connecticut, and he will go up and settle in the future Vermont, which at that time was considered the New Hampshire Grants, and it's disputed land between the colony of New York and the colony of New Hampshire as to who had the right claim to it. And New York had their equivalent of the Great Proprietors, and Ethan Allen is a leader of a group of settlers, most of whom have come up from western Massachusetts or western Connecticut, and they call themselves the Green Mountain Boys. And so they behave in many of the ways that are very similar to how the Maine settlers would behave. It's just that Ethan Allen and his Green Mountain Boys turn out to be even more successful, and they are able to create a new state of Vermont. Now, to the second question, which is about the border, it was in dispute from the start. Again, the Mitchell map is not particularly good, and it's a question of where does the channel for the Passamaquoddy River flow once you get out into the ocean, and where do these islands fall? And the British claimed all of the islands, and of course, the Maine people claim in the United States claimed all of the islands for themselves. And ultimately, there's again a compromise during the late 18 teens, and the United States will get the most important island, which is that of Eastport, whereas the other islands like Campobello will go to New Brunswick.
Mm-hmm. Pete, thank you for your question. An email from Andrew. I am interested in the role that the Cumberland and Oxford Canal played in statehood for Maine.
I got nothing.
Oh, well, Andrew, you'll have to do your own research and call us and let us know. We'll go to Haley calling from Portland. Hi, Haley. Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Taylor. I'm wondering if you could tell us a brief history of piracy in Maine.
I haven't really looked into piracy in Maine, so that's another one which I'm afraid I can't help you with.
All right. Well, thanks, Haley. An email from Peter. Captain Brian Pendleton is a relative. Know anything about him and his early work in organizing Maine?
No.
A Facebook message from Shane. Sean, where did the name Maine come from?
Well, there are two explanations. One of them is that it is the mainland because, from the perspective of the first European people to come here, who were fishermen, who were operating on islands like Monhegan, and they just referred to the mainland as Maine, the Maine. I think that's probably the right explanation. But the alternative explanation is that it comes from French explorers like Samuel de Champlain, who likened it to the province or to the region in France known as Maine. And so you have those two explanations, and we don't have a definitive answer for either one, and it comes down to whether you prefer a French explanation or an English one.
Do we know when it was first called? Is there a document when this area is first called Maine?
I can't give you a date on that. I'm assuming that it's in the early 17th century.
All right. An email from Eden. How many loyalists left Maine and went to Canada after the Revolution?
From Maine itself, probably not that many. From the United States in general, estimates run between 60,000 and 100,000. So I think from specifically from Maine, we're talking about maybe a couple of hundred. That's just a guess because I haven't looked into that question.
All right. An email from Bruce. I'm a land surveyor and have heard Mr. Taylor speak on Liberty Men at one of our meetings. I'm wondering if he has read the book about Martha Ballard, the Augusta midwife, whose husband was Ephraim, a well-known surveyor. Her diary includes great snippets about his work during the time just after the Revolution, when the royals weren't in charge of the lands being developed, but how the patriots acted in much the same way. One story she recorded was about how Ephraim was surveying east of the Kennebec, maybe in the Alna-Dresden area, when he was attacked by squatters dressed as Indians, much like the Boston Tea Party. Bruce, I'm so glad you sent this email because I have been reading Liberty Men and Great Proprietors at the same time I've been reading A Midwife's Tale. And I noticed, Professor Taylor, that you wrote this and published it the same year that Laurel Thatcher Ulrich wrote A Midwife's Tale, and you each acknowledge each other in your book. So you were talking with each other and writing about the same part of Maine at the same time.
Right. So as the question indicates, Martha Moore Ballard is married to Ephraim Ballard, and Ephraim Ballard's a very important character in the book that I wrote. So yes, we were very familiar with each other's work. We had shared unpublished work with each other in order to get comments and suggestions from each other. So it was one of the greatest strokes of good fortune of my very early career was meeting Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, and she in many ways served as my guide into understanding particularly family life in Maine. And so it also helped me to learn a lot about writing because she's a superb writer. And it helped me to learn a lot about research because she is such an extraordinary researcher.
You are both speaking tomorrow together at the University of Maine.
The day after tomorrow, Friday
at 5 o'clock at the University of Maine. And tomorrow, she will be our guest at Maine Calling. So talk about a stroke of luck to have Alan Taylor and Laurel Thatcher Ulrich back to back. Alan Taylor, thank you so much for joining us today on Maine Calling. Taylor is the University of Virginia Thomas Jefferson Foundation Chair in American History, a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning author, and as I said, in Maine to give two lectures as part of Maine's upcoming bicentennial celebration. If you are in Portland tonight or this early evening, 5 o'clock, you can find him at the Stroudwater Village Church, the information on our Facebook page and webpage. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Olivia Peruk took your calls. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.